try to do as much good possible as efficiently as possible. And that efficiency thing is really fun if you guys who are listening are out for a challenge. Like, one of the things that you can, I think this heightens the meaning in your life, is to try to do difficult things, right? Aim high. Don't aim so damn high you can't manage it, and make sure you break down your aims into reasonably attainable sub goals, but you want to aim high, and then you want to see how hyper efficient you can get. That's a great thing to do in your early 20s, is to see, okay, like, discipline yourself. You think, okay, how much work can I do if I load myself right to the maximum? How far can I work? How hard can I work until I exhaust myself? And then you back off, obviously, because the optimal amount of working, productive engagement, let's say, is that which is sustainable across decades. So you have to learn that, but you don't learn that without stretching yourself to your limits to begin with. And, you know, if your life isn't everything it could be, and if you're suffering from an excess of meaninglessness, well, it means you're not oriented in the world of chaos and order properly. It's like you could learn to discipline yourself. Figure out what it is that you need to do and that you want to do, and then see how efficient you can get. Because one of the things that's quite fun is to figure out, if you have a task, I always tell my graduate students this, if they're doing an experiment too, if you have a task that you have to do, it's really interesting to spend a few minutes, sometimes hours, depending on how long the task is, see if you can figure out how to do it from 5 to 10 times faster. It means you'll have to rearrange the way you think about it, but you can often do it. And that's how extremely productive people get so hyper efficient. You know, sometimes it means you have to delegate. Sometimes it means you have to bring other people aboard. That's delegation as well, I suppose. But there's a lot of preconceptions that you hold about who you are and who the world is that you could dispense with that would make you a way more efficient actor in the world. Ask yourself what would motivate you. You know, first of all, don't be studying 8 hours a day, because that isn't going to work and you're not going to do it anyways. You know, would you start studying 5 minutes a day? Seriously, could you bring it up to 10 minutes a day? What would you have to do for yourself to get yourself to sit down for half an hour a day and study intently? Like, maybe you'd have to, I don't know what you'd have to do, like have a beer at 6 o'clock at night or something, or maybe you'd have to go for a walk in the park or go out for coffee. It's like, imagine that you're sitting down with a stupid, undisciplined child and you're trying to get that child to do something useful. And you say, okay, look, I want you to do X, it's necessary, but you can pick how much of it you're going to do, and I'll give you what you want if you do it. Well, ask yourself that and see what happens. So don't try to tyrannize yourself, you know? Try to negotiate with yourself and use some reward and see how that works. And start slow, you know? Maybe you're not very disciplined and the best you can do is half an hour of studying it a day. Well, start with half an hour. Increase that 5 minutes a week. You know, if you do that, that's a lot. If you do that for a year, then you'll, by the end of the year, you'll be studying 4 hours a day. So you can, that's just with five minutes a week, right? Because that's 250 minutes in a year. So start ridiculously, pathetically. Study for 5 minutes a day for a week, and then move it to 10. You'll be able to do that. And don't cheat, you know, because one of the things people do is they make a deal with themselves like that. I'm going to study for 10 minutes a day, each day. And then they get into it and they think, wow, this is going really good. So they study for 2 hours, and then they've broken the contract with themselves and they don't trust themselves anymore. And then they don't study for a whole year, or, well, maybe not, for a month. So, but set your contract. Ask yourself, you know, what could I do to move myself forward to my goal that I would do, and then how could I improve that incrementally? You can't exist outside of a framework of value. It's not possible. It's not technically possible. I outline this in quite a bit of detail in chapter 10, which is called Rule 10, which is called Be Precise in Your Speech, is that the way the world manifests itself to you is integrally tied to your value structure. And that's because, to put it very simply, is that your very vision is dependent on an aim. Like, whenever you look at the world, you're aiming at something. You're aiming at something with your eyes. You can't focus on something without aiming at it, and you won't aim at it without valuing it. So your very perceptions are dependent on your value structure. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't a world. It does mean that experience is a complex interplay of your value structure and the unmanifest world. It's something like that. And then that begs the question, which is, well, if you have to have a value structure, then what should it be? Well, and then that brings us back to the ideas that we were talking about earlier. Like, you should value being. You should take on the responsibility of being as your highest ethical obligation and try to improve it, try to reduce suffering, try to make the most out of yourself in a way that's beneficial to you and your family and your community. You should aim high, and your perceptions will reconfigure themselves around those aims, and that will allow the world to manifest itself to you in the most positive possible manner, or at least in the most meaningful possible manner. And in the absence of that, all you have is stupid suffering. That is the anxiety and depression that we talked about earlier. Without a point, without value, without an aim, all you're left with is the misery and anxiety of life. That makes people bitter.
I love to bring up the notion of the aim, because one can react to this stupid suffering in a number of ways, but this is so clear. You write in it, you say, you cannot aim yourself at anything if you are completely undisciplined and untutored. Mm-hmm. You will not know what to target, you won't fly straight, even if you do get your aim right. And then you will conclude there is nothing to aim for, and then you will be lost. And these days, the prevailing moral framework, as I see it, is if it feels good, do it. How is it that discipline and the straight and narrow offer the best chance for a good life? How is it that we have forgotten that is the case?
Well, the reason that discipline is necessary is because you're a mass of competing short-term interests. And so the question is then, well, which short-term interest should win out? And the answer to that is, well, none of them. They need to be organized into a hierarchy that makes them functional across time and across individuals. So like a two-year-old is very likely to act out his or her proximal impulse. But of course, a two-year-old can't survive in the world. You have to bring your primary instincts, let's say, under the regulatory structure of a higher order value system that allows them to manifest themselves without undue mutual sacrifice across large spans of time in the presence of large numbers of other people. So that requires a very sophisticated ordering. It's like we already talked about the fact that a meta-narrative is necessary to unite subcultures, say, so that they can operate peacefully and harmoniously within the same space. The same thing applies within you, because you're like an internal coalition of warring single-minded tribes, and they have to all be brought under the organizational structure of long-term collective vision, let's say. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, you have to be disciplined. And any discipline, technically speaking, is an attempt to bring all those competing short-term impulses under a larger scale and more inclusive framework. And so you do that, and then, well, that's actually what gives you freedom. Being impulsive and being free aren't the same things, because if you're impulsive, you're just the slave of your impulses.
Right.
There's no freedom in that. That's the same freedom, so to speak, literally, that a two-year-old has, because a two-year-old isn't socialized yet. So that doesn't function in this sophisticated world. It doesn't work.
Right.
Everyone knows it.
We just like to pretend sometimes and say, oh, that does feel good, you know. Now, I have one
last... Well, we like to pretend all the time, because that's why we go out and drink, you know, because drinking enables you to blind yourself to the long-term consequences of your actions. And there's no doubt that that's very, very rewarding in the short term. But it's also why you wake up the next morning hungover and ashamed. It's very difficult to properly organize your immediate environment. And that's another thing I try to do with the books, is show that some of these so-called simple things, clean your room. It's like, I'll tell you, this is the truth. I've been trying to organize my office for 3 years. I was flooded by so much mail and so much catastrophe that I fell way behind in my ability to keep my closet organized, my clothes organized. I had 3 years worth of mail sitting in my office at the university, thousands of pieces of mail. And it took a lot of work to
And it's still not done. I hope I'll have my damn room clean by the time I go out on tour, for symbolic purposes, among other reasons, to have my house in order and beautified again as well. But I like to show that simple things aren't so simple, especially if you try them. You know, I had one client, his mother had died, and it was a large family, and the family kind of fell into disorder after she died, because it was all boys, it was all sons and a father, and no one had really picked up the maternal role, you know, the necessary stereotypical maternal role. And he decided he was going to try to do that. And man, you know, his brothers and his father, they weren't happy when he first went to get groceries. You know, they felt that he was kind of trying to take the place of the mother. So there was all that grief that was still there. And then who the hell did he think he was? And et cetera, et cetera. I mean, people's houses aren't in order because that's really hard. It's really hard. And it causes a lot of chaos and strife to try to do it. And so usually it isn't done. And it isn't until you actually try it, like right down to the detail, that you start to understand how difficult it is. And then also how to appreciate. You also start to appreciate how necessary it is. So it's fun shedding light on that sort of thing. And the non-triviality of the ordinary. And part of the reason I concentrate on the individual is because I don't think the things we do are trivial. If you think the things you do are trivial, then you're either bringing a trivial attitude towards them, or you're doing things that you're not doing the things you should be doing, or you're not framing the situation appropriately. So, and you know, you might dispute that, but and that's okay, you could, but you know, one thing that my depressive clients, for example, would say, I can't really figure out why anything is worth doing if we're all going to die in the end. It's like, you know, it's fair enough. But I said, I think it was last night in my lecture, I said, if a baby's crying in front of you and you know it's cold or hungry, you don't cease to attend to its distress because the sun is going to envelop the earth in 4 billion years. You think, that's not a good excuse. Well, why not? Why not use that time frame? And your instinctive answer is, well, that's just not the appropriate time frame. And so I would say, well, if you have the habitual inclination to apply to your own life a time frame or an evaluative framework that reduces what you're doing to meaninglessness, then you should consider whether or not you're using the wrong time frame. Right? If it all of a sudden becomes meaningless, pointless, you're suffering in the work you have to do, well, find a time frame that is appropriate, you know, sufficient unto the day, let's say. That's a good start.
I was talking to one of the leaders of the conservatives this morning, and they're asking me about, the person was asking me about Bill C-16, but more specifically about talking to young people, because the conservative leadership struggle is going on right now. I've been talking to a bunch of them, and I said, well, look, one of the things you could do for young people that no one's doing is to talk to them about responsibility. Because everyone talks to young people about rights. It's like, we need our rights. It's like, oh God, how many rights do you need? You know, really, like you have more privileges than any people who've ever lived anywhere. Well, it's so dull to hear. It's so dull. It's so pathetic. And what would you call it? It's so demeaning that you have to be protected and have your rights. It's like I said, there's a huge marketplace for responsibility. That's what you want to talk to young people about. It's like, get your act together and do something worthwhile with your life. For the first time in my entire adult life, the conservatives actually have something to sell young people, right? They can sell them responsibility. It's like, well, why? Because that's where life has meaning with responsibility. The more responsibility you take on, the more meaning your life has. And the higher degree of responsibility that you agree voluntarily to try to bear, the richer your life will be. And no one's ever told that, and it's the case. You know, it's like you have 4 kids, say. Well, that's plenty of responsibility. You're going to have meaning. It's going to be rough, you know, because it's complicated. You have a complicated job, and you try to help the careers of the people around you. You try to solve tough problems and aid suffering and do all of that. It's like, it's weight, it's responsibility, but there's glory in it. There's real glory in it. There's deep meaning in it. And and young people are starving for that because no one ever tells them that. It's like, you're way more than you think. Man, stand up. Do something difficult. Do something difficult and heroic, right? Burst out of your bonds. It's like, that's a good message. It's a necessary message. Because we have to be more than we are. Because if we aren't, we're not going to survive.
Generally, if I engage in conflict, the reason I engage in it is because I think the alternative is worse. And so, you know, if you're trying to settle things with a family member, there's often a terrible minefield that you have to wander through to reach anything approximating a lasting peace, and avoiding it doesn't make it better, and it's terrible to confront it, and it can be virtually beyond your capacity to tolerate to do it, and so people avoid it very frequently, but that doesn't make peace. It just harbors underground resentment and breeds bitterness and hatred, and so that's not, unless that's what you want, that's not a good solution.
Why do you think it is that some of the things that you've said and the way you've gone about kind of writing up your stuff has been such a phenomenon and caused so many people to sit up and pay attention?
Well, I suppose in some sense those things that we take for granted we regard as obvious, but if we take them for granted and we regard them as obvious and then they're challenged, we often have no idea why they're valuable. You know, so for example, I've had many clients who were considering getting married or were not getting married, and they would say to me, well, it's just a piece of paper. And they thought that was a pretty good argument. And that's not a good argument at all. That's an argument that's so shallow that you hardly know where to begin. But, you know, if someone comes up to you on the street and says, defend marriage, it's like, well, what do you know? It's like, how are you going to do that? It's what's so obvious that it's defensible that you don't have the arguments at hand. I mean, you know, you're not a legal philosopher. And so people who do that, they think they're intelligent because they can put you on the spot. But merely the mere fact that you can't articulate a claim you share with almost everyone in some traditional sense doesn't mean either that you're stupid or that the principle itself is invalid. It just means that we tend not to discuss all those things we agree upon. It doesn't mean they're without merit. So the rules, I mean, I've been criticized, my books have been criticized. Well, they're, you know, self-help. And I think, well, I'm actually not contemptuous of that. So that criticism doesn't bother me. My clinical practice, many of my clients were brought to whatever philosophical understanding they had through so-called self-help books. And if they were reading books, you know, that's not so bad. And what were they trying to do, improve themselves? I mean, how pathetic is that? And then to pander to an audience that needs self-improvement. You know, it's like, well, so yes, the rules were obvious, but the reasons for them weren't. And so I think the reason the books were popular, or one of the reasons, is that I tried to make a case for why these hypothetically simple axiomatic propositional statements were neither simple nor obvious, and why they were also necessary. And people like to be walked through the whole process of the thought that underlies the claim, let's say.
Responsibility, I think, is an incredible message.
Yeah, the responsibility element has been well received by people, and I think maybe that's because that message isn't being delivered as effectively as it should be. The idea that meaning is to be found in responsibility.
Yeah, you're saying it hasn't been developed? You're saying it hasn't been promoted as much?
Well, yeah. There's so much of an emphasis on rights. I mean, imagine if our culture was as dominated by discussion of responsibility as it was dominated by discussion of rights.
Yeah,
right. Completely. I mean, that's just not how it is at all.
Right.
And that's strange because your rights, in some sense, are my responsibility, and vice versa. So, right, because you're accorded rights, it's distance from other people in some sense, and for them it's the same, and so you can't have one discussion without the other.
Mm-hmm.
But our discussion has been very one-sided, and I think that's hard on people because it's about what you're owed.
Yeah.
And it isn't obvious to me that I don't know. It doesn't, it isn't, it's not like not getting what you're owed isn't annoying. It is, if you feel that an injustice has been committed. But it isn't obvious to me that people find the deepest meaning in their life in getting what they're owed. I really do think that people find more significance in their life in being of utility and service to other people. That's how it looks to me. So, and often that's discussed in a sort of should way, you know, you should be good to other people. It's like, well, your life is better if you do that. That's a different way of putting it. And you can get people to think about that. It's like, well, remember those times when people were particularly happy with something that you did, something for them. How did you feel about that? Well, you can figure that out for yourself. Maybe it didn't matter, but probably it mattered. Probably you'd like to have that happen a lot more.
But I think even more so, the feeling that you get when you have a responsibility and you deliver on it. Hmm. I think that, for me, that feels even more meaningful, that you uphold your end of the bargain, that you make someone's life better. That feels even better than when someone says, thank you for that. Thank you for doing that.
Mm-hmm. Like, right. No, absolutely. No, I wasn't thinking so much about the consequences of the thanks. Mm-hmm. That's just an indication that you did something, you know, that was productive and useful and caring, let's say. And yeah, And I think people know that too, that when they're operating properly, parents find tremendous meaning in the service they provide to their children, obviously. And I think you find that within a relationship, what you give. I mean, it's reciprocal, obviously. There has to be reciprocity, but it's better to concentrate at least half the time on what you're giving. I don't think that young people, especially in later days in junior high, high school, maybe even earlier than that, are taught enough to think about what they want and how they would go about getting it. And I mean what they want in a deep sense, like how their friendships could be better, how their relationships with their parents could be better, how their life could be better, practically speaking. So we tried to design a program to help younger people do the self-authoring program, but my health interfered with that and it fell by the wayside, unfortunately. But it's helpful for people to take stock of themselves and to chart a course. And I don't think our education system does a very good job of helping people develop a vision of themselves, a story for themselves. And it's a problem because it also means that they're not ennobled or encouraged the way they should be. And I've seen this all constantly during my lectures, that people are so happy to be encouraged. They're often met with skepticism instead. And I think that's part of the problem with what's happening in our culture politically too, is that, you know, there's this terrible critique of our culture, that it's all its institutions are fundamentally predicated on arbitrary power, the exercise of arbitrary power. And that implies that the ambitions of people who wish to join that culture and to thrive are expressions of tyrannical, oppressive, arbitrary power. It's very demoralizing to young people. And I don't believe it's true, because I don't think the fundamental motivation is to exploit others. I think that people who do that fail, generally speaking, often precipitously. Societies that organize themselves around that principle are miserable and collapse. They're full of deceit and backstabbing and distrust. It's hell. And so I think that young people are best encouraged. And that means that you have to sort of like them. Like you're a mentor. It's like, I'm on the side of the good in you, and I hope it manifests itself. And I think that's what trust is for, by the way. You know, you should trust other people. Why? They can bite. Why would you trust them? Well, because it's courageous to. And that way you elicit the best from them. At least that's the best opportunity you have. You're going to get hurt sometime. You're going to get hurt distrusting too. But societies without trust are hell on earth. So
trusting
that's for sure.
Next generation, though, starts with you having it in the first place, right? That's sort of passing along those patterns, as if I don't trust anyone, I'm going to instill that in my child. Like, well, yeah. The world's not to be trusted.
You can try to change that, you know, and if you know that trust is courage, that can help. Because while trust can be just naivety, I trust you because I'm too foolish to know the difference. You know, I've never been hurt. I've never encountered someone malevolent, so I'm naive. And I trust. That's not trust. That's blind faith in an environment that's been too benevolent for your own good. But trust, that's more like, well, we'll think the best of you to begin with and see what happens. And then if you make a mistake, well, we'll deal with that and we'll go back to trust. And those are stable negotiating strategies. And so that's, young people need to be confronted with that, and then they need to be helped to chart their course. And that's hard, you know, it takes a fair bit of individual attention because people are so complicated. I produce this other technology at Self-Authoring that helps people write about their past, analyze their faults and their virtues, and write a plan for the future. It's a useful way of figuring out who you are. You kind of have to hit yourself against the world, but you know, you tell the story about your past, and that helps you understand where you came from. You figure out your virtues and your faults. That sort of helps you understand your strengths and weaknesses. And then a plan gives you a course for the future. It's hard to do all that writing, but it's hard to blunder through life too without a plan. So it's hard either way.
Pick your heart. So, you always talk about that. Choose the difficult, or the difficult will choose you eventually, and you might not like it as much, right?
Yeah, well, when it's necessary, like I wouldn't say to go out of your way necessarily to make your life difficult, but if you have a difficult choice in front of you and it's either abandon what you know you should be doing or do the difficult thing, well, you're going to pay a price for abandonment. So, and I guess I would also say that to understand yourself, it's quite useful to try to not lie, because you tangle yourself up in your own lies. People think they can get away with lying, but you can't get away with falsifying the structure of the world. You're going to pay for it. I've never seen anybody get away with anything in my clinical practice. No, something, the other shoe always dropped. Always, always. And unsurprisingly, if you drop a weight on your head, above your head, like, it's fine until it hits you. Yeah.
But then there's changing your mind.
Yeah, there, you can be wrong. That's different. That's a good point, though. It's difficult to dissociate ignorance from lying. But, you know, you get punished when you're wrong often. But that's different, you know. It's not like it's nothing to be ignorant, to be wrong. It's still hard on you. But it's a different kind of hard to be willfully wrong. One of the real advantages, I think a lot of the current political movements are quasi-religions, essentially. And religious structures have collapsed very badly. And so these things arise to take their place, because we need a religious structure. Because that's what provides us with our fundamental story. The fundamental story of life is a religious story, by definition. That's what I mean by that. Is the most fundamental story you have is the closest thing you have to a religion. So
we started there. I mean, we started with the stories.
Yes, yes. Well, and metaphysics be damned. But, you know, I don't know what the fundamental significance of consciousness is. So, and neither does anybody else. So there's plenty of room for metaphysical speculation. It's hard to know what each person's destiny is. But in any case, the problem with so many ideological stories is that they give you an easy enemy. And that's extremely dangerous. And maybe the enemy, they always give you an enemy. Yeah, that's a real problem.
So that seems so like one of the biggest problems, is there's always an enemy.
Well, the biggest problem is the enemy isn't you. You're your worst enemy.
I agree.
That's the right place to start. And so, you know, one of the advantages, I think, of Christianity, although I don't think it's limited to Christianity, is that it insists that that's the battleground. You. right? And so if you need an enemy, and maybe you do, look within. So I just had a long discussion with Jocko Willink, and Jocko states very forthrightly in that interview, that discussion, that ever since he was 3 years old, he wanted to be a soldier, and he disavows any higher order moral virtue to that desire. He wanted to go out and be a soldier, to do what soldiers do. It was intrinsic. It was an intrinsic part of his personality. And make no mistake about it, I mean, we've been warriors forever, and some people are born like that. And he's definitely one of them. But he's highly socialized. We get less aggressive as we age, human beings. The most violent creatures are two-year-olds. Punch, kick, hit, bite, steal. That's the definition. Physical violence. Okay. Two-year-olds, if you group people together in age similar groupings, the two-year-olds have the most violent altercations. But then if you look at the two-year-olds, it's a minority of the two-year-olds who are violent. They're almost all male, and it's a small minority of the males. Okay, most of those males are socialized out of that antisocial aggression by the time they're four. Those that aren't are permanently antisocial, although that declines after the age of about 27. So let's take that minority of aggressive kids. So, well, what does it mean to be aggressive? And this pertains to psychopathy. Psychopathy isn't a unitary dimension. It's not a personality attribute. It's a combination of traits. And so a real psychopath is low in agreeableness. So low in compassion, low in politeness. That's the best personality predictor of criminal behavior. It's not very good, but it's the best one. And they're low in conscientiousness. Okay, so they have a parasitic lifestyle, that's low in conscientiousness, and they have no empathy. That's bad news. And then you can decorate the psychopathy. You could add low neuroticism to that, so there's no fear. You could add assertiveness from the extroversion dimension. So like your ultimate psychopath might be charming and assertive, right? Low in fear, low in agreeableness, low in conscientiousness. So they don't care about you. They'll exploit you for the future. They don't forego gratification, but they're charming. Then you can decompose that and you can say, well, those constituent elements of those traits are often extremely useful. Now, Jocko and his crew, the Navy SEAL types, they're deadly when you put them out against an enemy, but they're unbelievably socialized. Like Jocko stated very straightforwardly and makes a very credible case that the Navy SEALs, their fundamental motivation isn't status for themselves, it's to protect the other people in the group. They're incredibly group affiliated, and I think you see that in any functional group of competitive men, is they compete for the position, but they have each other's backs. And if they don't, what you do with a guy like that, who you can't trust in the clinch, is you isolate him. Even if he's competent, if he won't subserve that competence to the group, you don't trust him. Because in order to be in a position of authority for any length of time, you have to play an iterable game. It has to be able to repeat. And unless you engage in reciprocal behaviors with others, you can't dominate a social group for very long because it'll rebel. So there's real constraints on the exercise of power in any functional hierarchy. And you even see that among chimps. Franz De Waal has documented this extremely well. The tyrant chimp can prevail momentarily, but the probability that he's going to get taken out is extremely high. And it's actually the pro-social chimp who's strong and fearless, let's say, that's much more likely to have a stable reign, let's say. So you can even see that in chimps. So I'm leery of the, you know, CEOs equal psychopath argument. It's like, well, yeah, they're competitive, but they're conscientious. So that ameliorates the psychopathy, right? Like a disagreeable, conscientious person is really useful to have around, because they will tell you exactly what they think, because they don't care if they hurt your feelings. And that's kind of harsh. They will tell you, man, you'll know. But if they're conscientious, you can trust them.
One of the things that happens very often in psychotherapy. You know, people come to psychotherapy for multiple reasons. But one of them is they often come because they're too agreeable. And so what they get is so-called assertiveness training, although it's not exactly assertiveness that's being trained. What it is the ability to learn how to negotiate on your own behalf. And one of the things I tell agreeable people, especially if they're conscientious, is say what you think. Tell the truth about what you think. There's going to be things you think that you think are nasty and harsh, and they probably are nasty and harsh, but they're also probably true. And you need to bring those up to the forefront and deliver the message. And it's not straightforward at all, because agreeable people do not like conflict. Not at all. They smooth the water. You know, and you can see why that is, in accordance with the hypothesis that I've been putting forward. You don't want conflict around infants. It's too damn dangerous. You don't want fights to break out. You don't want anything to disturb the relative peace. You know, and if you're also more prone to being hurt physically and perhaps emotionally, you're also maybe loath to engage in the kind of high-intensity conflict that will solve problems in the short term. Because it takes a lot of conflict to solve problems in the short term. And, you know, if that can spiral up to where it's dangerous, which it can if it gets uncontrolled, it might be safer in the short term to keep the waters smooth and to not delve into those situations where conflict emerges. The problem with that is it's not a very good medium to long-term strategy, right? Because lots of times there are things you have to talk about because they're not going to go away. And so partly what you do with agreeable people is you get them to figure out, and they have a hard time with this too. If you ask a disagreeable person what he wants, say, or she wants, they'll tell you right away. They know. It's like, this is what I want and this is how I'm going to get it. But agreeable people, especially if they're really agreeable, are so agreeable that they often don't even know what they want, because they're so accustomed to living for other people and to finding out what other people want and to trying to make them comfortable and so forth, that it's harder for them to find a sense of their own desires as they move through life. And that's not... Look, there's situations where that's advantageous, but it's certainly not advantageous if you're going to try to forge yourself a career. That just doesn't work at all.
This is part of the reason that I'm an admirer of Carl Jung, because Jung makes it very clear that, see, he was very interested in the barriers to enlightenment. Because if there's such a thing as being enlightened, let's say, then why isn't everyone enlightened? If it's just a matter of taking the glorious route and following your bliss, let's say, it's like, well, that sounds pretty easy. Why isn't everyone enlightened? But Jung's thinking isn't like that at all. You know, he believed that in order to transform your personality, that first of all, you had to be disciplined, that's for sure. But you also had to integrate that part of you that was terrible and capable of breaking rules and make it part of you. And so then, and I really like that idea. Well, here's an example. So about 20 years ago, I would say, there was a newspaper headline in one of Canada's major newspapers. And it was the Minister of Foreign Affairs at that time, Lloyd Axworthy, and he was talking about what had happened with Milosevic in the former Soviet Union in Yugoslavia and the atrocities that were being committed. And he said that he was caught unawares by that because he didn't have the imagination for that kind of evil. And I thought, well, you know, you think that what you're doing is signaling your virtue by making a statement like that, but from my perspective, all you're doing is stating your cowardice and your historical ignorance, because if you're going to be Minister of Foreign Affairs, you bloody well better have imagination for that kind of evil. Because if you don't, then anyone who does wins. They beat you. And so you know, again, in the Harry Potter stories, you see, he's touched by evil, right? He actually has a soul fragment that's embedded within him that's as black as anything can possibly be. That's why he can talk to snakes. But without that, he wouldn't be able to have any victory. And that's exactly right psychologically. Unless you can think the way that an evil person thinks, then you're defenseless against them, because they'll go places you can't imagine and then they win. And so the best men I've met, it was interesting, even when I was in junior high and high school, because most of my friends dropped out, you know, by the time they're grade 10 thereabouts. And a lot of them were guys who developed physically, they're pretty powerful, and they're just damn sick of putting up their hand to go to the bathroom. It's like, you know, they're not doing that anymore. One of my friends got kicked out when he sort of challenged the gym teacher, you know, physically. And the gym teacher, he could do an iron cross. He was a tough guy. And so it was no trivial matter for my friend to stand up to him, but he got expelled anyways. But, you know, I noticed that
It was often the kids whose character I admired that either quit or got expelled, and they were the tougher guys who were just sick and tired of following rules that didn't take into account their character, and then they'd go off and work in the oil rigs or whatever, and you could do that in Alberta at that time. That was really hard work, you know, so it wasn't like they were necessarily taking the easy path. But, like, a harmless man is not a good man. A good man is a very, very dangerous man who has that under voluntary control. And, you know, you also see that, like, one of the central female stories, let's say, if the hero archetype is the central male story, there are variants of hero archetypes that are relevant to women, and one of them is Beauty and the Beast. And, you know, Beauty isn't interested in the guy who isn't the Beast. She's interested in the guy who's the Beast, and that's exactly right, but she's interested in the guy who's the Beast that can be civilized and disciplined, right, and who can use that in the service, well, let's say, of a family. Look, a great hunter, let's say, might become a leader in a hunter-gatherer group, but part of what makes him a great hunter is the fact that he shares. I mean, he hunts, but he has to share, and that's also to his benefit, because then if someone else hunts and is successful, he gets his share. But so there's the aggression that goes along with hunting, and the dominance that goes along with maybe the seeking of status in that particular domain. But no complex human hierarchy is sustainable without reciprocity, and that's why the Marxist criticisms of hierarchy as only based in power, they're just wrong. It's just not the case. When a hierarchy degenerates, then it becomes based on power. Any hierarchy, it could be a creative hierarchy, it could be a competency hierarchy. If it's power, then it's degenerated. It's become the evil tyrant, and then it's time for a revolution. And so, you know, the revolutionary Marxist types can take that fundamental truth, which is that sometimes it's time for a revolution, and that's when power dominates. And they can use that as a motivator, because it speaks to us very deeply. But it's very dangerous to apply that to situations where what's producing hierarchical position is multifactorial. And no one in their right mind, if they think about it, as far as I'm concerned, can say that the functional hierarchies that characterize most social organizations in the West, they're just not based on power. That's just wrong. Plumbers, competency. Lawyers, competency. Might be dominance and assertiveness and even a lack of empathy. Among prosecutors, for example, you know, you have to have a killer instinct. But it's competence. It's ability to do the job.
What has been your experience with dealing with these men who have these nice guy tendencies, who can't stand up for themselves, who their moms raised them to be this type of anti-man?
Yeah, well, sometimes that can also be temperamental, right? Because if a man happens to be high in agreeableness, this is also true of women, they're much more conflict averse and they're nicer in their temperament. So if you get an agreeable boy, let's say, who also has a doting mother, then you might have that problem. There's other ways of having that problem, but that's one way. Well, when I saw people like that in therapy, they were often resentful and angry and passive aggressive and getting in their own way, often to spite, you know, whoever was doting on them, let's say. And so the first thing I would do is listen to why they were there, and then start to unpack that anger, and then start to work with the individual to figure out how to voice that. You know, you have to separate out what's old history and useless, and what's just narcissism and infantilism from genuine concerns. But if you listen to people, they will sort that out for themselves. That's one of the cool things about being a therapist, is if you listen, that happens more or less by itself. And then, as a behavioral psychologist, you know, maybe someone like that would need a raise, but would be afraid to ask their boss. Well, we just practice that. It's like, okay, well, first of all, why should your boss give you a raise? Like, there might be good reasons. He doesn't want to lose you because you're a good worker. Well, are you a good worker? And if you weren't, well, we'd solve that problem. Put yourself in a position where
you deserve the raise. Okay, well, now you're too timid or you're too unskilled, because you have to differentiate those two things too, because some people who can't stand up for themselves actually don't know how, whereas others are afraid, and some are both. And so you have to figure out, so some of it's skill training. Well, how do you actually ask your boss for a raise? Well, you tell the truth. That's the best way. You say, look, you know, here's what I'm doing. Here's why it's really useful for you. It looks like I'm somewhat underpaid in this role. That's demotivating me, possibly. I also have other options. I think I need, you know, 15% more, and I'm interested in moving up, and here's what I'll do for you if you do that. And so, you know, think about it. And then if your boss doesn't do that and all that's true, well, then you should be assertive enough to find another job. Or maybe you look for another job before you even ask for the raise. Put your CV together, right? Update it so you're not afraid to look for another job. All this is strategic thinking. That was another thing that was really fun about clinical work. Most of my clients, they doubled or tripled their salaries within 3 or 4 years. You know, they worked at it. This wasn't nothing. This was major league strategic planning. And that was true for women and men, you know, so, and that's very fun to watch that happen. Think clearly about it, right? And get your act together, you know, and you got to see what's getting in your way. So maybe you're afraid to ask your boss for a raise, because if he says no, you'd have to look for a job, and you don't have your resume or CV updated. And the reason you don't have it updated is because you're embarrassed about it's the lacks in it. And you don't want to face the lacks, because then you'd have to see how you didn't get educated properly because you were useless. And you'd have to take steps to rectify that. And like, it's a real mess down there, right? The reasons you're not asking. So we'd lay that all out and then say, well, you're embarrassed about your resume. Well, update it and let's take a look at it. Okay, well, here's some holes, and they're not good. What could you do to fix those? And then you break it down into small steps, right? Implementable steps, because that's very practical. So that's a good thing to know. If you have your sight set on a goal, you'll move towards it if you break the steps down small enough so that even someone as useless as you will do it. And that also requires a fair bit of humility, because what you might find, especially if you're avoiding something, is that the step you are actually willing to take is so small that you're embarrassed to admit it to yourself, so you won't take any steps at all. Well, that's completely counterproductive. And the reason that's not proper thinking, let's say, or productive thinking, is that, well, small steps get bigger real fast. And it doesn't matter where you start. If you're doubling your utility every, you know, few weeks, who cares where you start? It starts to take off real quick. So you don't want to be embarrassed. You don't want to be so embarrassed by where you are that it stops you from becoming who you could be. And that's tough. It can be that's real tough. I'm not making light of that. I see exactly why people avoid, but it's not a good solution. So for assertiveness, that's what you do, you know. And maybe you practice how people, maybe they're afraid to, you know, ask a woman for a phone number. And so you practice that. And then you use exposure training. It's like, well, go out and practice that. Say hi to a pretty woman when you pass her on the street. That's your task for this week. And see how you do. See how you respond. See if you can do that. See if you avoid. And if you do avoid, see what you're thinking when you avoid. You know, and see if you made eye contact. And if you were standing up reasonably straight, like, you know, like a reasonable human being. And we'd practice these tiny things, because they are not tiny, man. You wouldn't believe how many people don't have friends because they don't know how to introduce themselves and shake hands. I bet you there's 5% of the population has no friends at all because they don't know how to do that.
Wow.
It's really sad.
It is. It's extremely sad. And I see it all the time. And I love what you talked about, the being proactive about, you know, going over your fears, because I think for a lot of nice guys is the fear of rejection, the fear of failure is such a crippling thing, to where, which is why they either, you know, disappear into the shadows or just be extremely agreeable. So
yeah, well, here's a cure for that, man. It's like, do you want the horror of failure or the certainty of failure? The horror of potential failure or the certainty of failure? Because if you don't do this, you will fail. Now, it'll be put off, but it will absolutely happen. And so that fear, I understand why that stops people. It's no joke to be rejected. And it's going to happen while you practice. And it's a real fear. But you're deluding yourself by thinking that there's a no fear option. There's just a delayed fear option, right? Because if you don't get this right, well, you're going to fail for sure. And then you're going to be miserable and vindictive and bitter and anxiety ridden. And you're going to cause trouble for yourself. And you're going to take it out on women and other men. And like, that's an ugly path, man. And so I see why you're afraid, but you should be way more afraid of that. And that's a nice way to help people get their thinking straight about fear. It's like no zero fear path.
And a lot of men don't have encouraging messages to start them on a journey to success.
It's really, if you're afraid of male power, let's say, crippling them is one solution.
Yeah.
Now, it's not a good solution. And that's going to happen if you think of the patriarchy as a tyrant. And look, there's reasons to think that, you know. So I was watching this movie, King Arthur, by Guy Ritchie. And when the new king, young King Arthur, takes his sword, he has flashbacks to his evil uncle killing his father. And it's so terrible that he can't hold on to the sword. And I thought, well, what's Ritchie doing there? That's the case for all of us, isn't it? Because when we look into the past and we see our evil uncles, it's just a complete bloody catastrophic mess, isn't it? Slavery and genocide and war and oppression and that's on all of us, isn't it? And it's always lurking there in the background. And so is that male power? Well, yes, in some ways. I mean, if you don't give a man a sword, he can't use a sword, right? So not giving him a sword is one way of making sure he's peaceful, but it's not the optimal way. And besides, if you cripple men, they become far more dangerous. They become dangerous in an terrible underground fashion. Of course, the same is exactly true if you cripple women, but we're speaking particularly of boys, because I suppose there's an education crisis among boys and young men. Well, you want to encourage that power because it's actually a tremendous force for good if it's brought under control. And so, but that's a hard thing to get right. And it also requires a lot of trust and work on the part of women because they want to, it's like Beauty and the Beast, right? Because beauty entices that beast who's real, but uncivilized and dangerous. She sort of entices him into becoming fully developed. And that's what a woman has to do when she, you know, has that work project that she marries or has a long-term relationship with. But it's much better to encourage with faith and trust. In my writings and my lectures, I've tried to encourage people to deal with malevolence at the level of the individual. Because when you start dealing with it in others, there's a big risk in that. It's like clean up your own house, which is
right.
I mean,
right.
I've been parodied for that. So, well, look at all the social problems in the world. And Dr. Peterson is telling the oppressed to clean up their rooms. It's like, how is that going to solve anything? It's, well, first of all, have you tried it, actually? It's not that bloody easy to clean up your room.
Right.
And so
it's harder. It's much easier to clean somebody else's room.
Yes. Or it's certainly a lot easier to point to the mess in someone else's room.
Yes.
And, you know, there's such a danger. There's such a danger in that. And it's so attractive, right, to identify, to localize malevolence externally. It's so attractive because, first of all, it lets you off the hook. And that's a relief. Mm-hmm. And second, if you've identified malevolence, there's nothing you can do to what is malevolent that's unjustifiable. Mm-hmm. And so your worst impulses have free reign. Because especially if you can also add to that a good cause, mm-hmm. you know, you say, well, this is in the service of the eventual utopia. It's like, well, now you have carte blanche for your worst motivations. And that's very, very dangerous. And so I always think that it's better to stick to the psychological.
How do you get people to recognize and then have the courage to stand? You've taken a beating. Nobody wants to do that. Why is that worth it, and how do you get there?
Well, I think it's worth it because the alternative, I believe the alternative is worse. I mean, that's why I think it's worth it. I think it's
What's
a decision that you make. To stay silent when you have something to say. You know, you don't know what it is within you that requires your voice, right? Because you feel, I have something to say. It's like, well, where does that come from exactly, that feeling that you have something to say? You're disgruntled at work and you're choking on your own bile because the situation is not just in your estimation. You're dying to say something, but you won't. Well, you'll die if you don't say it. Maybe it's a death of 1,000 cuts. I don't like deferred punishment. I'd rather take it now and keep the future clean, which is why I encourage people to have the fights now. Not to hide things in the fog for later, because they grow and metastasize. It's better to confront what you need to confront when it's small and when you have some possibility of victory. One of the things that I puzzled out a long while back and tried to adhere to the best of my ability, was driven by exactly the concern that you're expressing. Because I realized that the instinct for meaning is a genuine instinct, and it underlies even our attention. It's unbelievably deep. It's the deepest thing about us. Okay, but what about
the
people
search?
Who pursue?
The search for meaning? That's that? Or
the experience
meaning
and the search. Okay. Well, I would say both of those. Both of those are okay. They're somewhat independent, because the search for meaning is very motivating, but the experience of meaning is something in and of itself. We talked about that in relationship to the night sky, for example.
Right.
So, okay, but your objection was, well, what if that meaning instinct goes wrong? It's like, yeah, what if? What if? Okay, how do you make it go wrong? Lie and see what happens. Because you'll pathologize that instinct, and then you're lost. So if you understand that, there isn't anything more frightening than understanding that. Because your stability as an entity, as a soul, is dependent on your relationship with that instinct for meaning. And if you pathologize that with deceit, you will find yourself in the hands of things that you do not want to be in the hands of. Put it that way.
The argument today is, there is no truth. Whose truth? That's my truth. It's your truth. I think what you're saying is you find meaning in truth. And if you're lying about something, then that's the absence of truth. But
well, if you tell the truth to the best of your ability, then you can trust your instincts to some degree. To the greatest degree that you're capable of. And then that can help orient you in the world properly. You can rely on your instincts if you don't pathologize the information that you're feeding yourself. So, you know, if you want to live in harmony with yourself, which you would assume to be somewhat desirable rather than a hellish disharmony, then don't feed yourself what's indigestible. And certainly don't warp the world around you with deceit you know to be deceitful. It's extraordinarily damaging and dangerous. Well, because I realized that the instinct for meaning could become pathologized, that's what made me obsessed to begin with about the spoken word, with free speech, for example. You were also talking about what orients us in the middle. Well, the thing about the middle is where the middle is shifts, because the environment around us shifts, the natural world shifts, the social world shifts, and so that middle moves on us. And so what we do is we talk to each other, which is a form of thinking. Thinking is internalized speech. So the dialogue we're having is thought. If I'm thinking, I just have that dialogue in my head by myself. It's still a dialogue between two viewpoints. So we orient ourselves with untrammeled, honest speech in a constant search to find that optimal middle ground. But it always moves. So we are destined in some sense to continually communicate about where we should be, that's for sure. But the idea that there's a desirable middle that we can attain through dialogue, well, that's a presupposition of Western individualism. So if you buy the idea that our institutions are basically predicated on tyrannical power, So that's the basis for institutional organization is power. Then you buy the argument that the dialogue between institutions is nothing but the expression of that power. There are no individuals and there's no space for rational negotiation. And that case is being made constantly, particularly by radicals on the left. It is fundamentally anti-individual. And there is no room in that system for free speech itself. It's not like it's anti-free speech. That's a misconception. Something isn't anti-free speech if it has no room whatsoever for the concept of free speech. That's a much deeper criticism. And that's part of what's driving this identity politics movement. It's an assault on the idea of the individual word, the word itself. It's an assault on the idea of the redemptive power of the word itself. There's no individuals. There's no rational discourse. There's no possibility of meeting in the middle. There's no middle. There's just a territory defined by struggles for power between groups. That's why it's okay not to invite someone who disagrees with you. They don't disagree with you. They represent a different power structure. And you might think you have an opinion, but you don't. You're merely mouthing the platitudes of your social structure. You're not there as an individual, not from that perspective. This is a much more radical critique than people generally realize. It goes all the way to the bottom. Write it out. Yep, write it out, write it out. Everything you can remember about it. We have software online at a site called selfauthoring.com that helps people write an autobiography. And so they go through their lives, breaking their lives into epochs and identifying the most emotionally and practically significant events and detailing them. And that's all in an attempt to help people forget and to let go of uncertainty and threat and anxiety and, well, the whole panoply of negative emotions that their life memories might otherwise be contaminated with. And so you do that in therapy continually with people when you're talking about their past. And it isn't catharsis. The Freudians believed, for example, that if someone had a traumatic experience and then they were able to express the emotion that was associated with that experience, that that would be curative. But it doesn't look like it's the expression of the emotion. It looks like it's the extraction of the significance of the event.